So the title I gave for my talk tonight is called it The Dhamma of Loneliness. And this came about because I was, as I do, rereading one of my Dhamma books. And I was rereading When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron. And there is a section in here, in this book, that just struck me. I mean, it's funny how, you know, you read things 10 years ago and then you read them again now, and it's like, oh, I never thought of it quite, you know, it's like, kind of, I don't remember ever reading this section, though I know I read the whole book 10 years ago, right? So, like, it's interesting to see what catches you as you change and as your practice change, I suppose. And what she's talking about initially in this book is what she calls the middle path. You know, which is how the Buddha's teachings are often described as the middle path. And I'd always thought of the middle path mainly as, you know, this idea of right effort, of, you know, not too tight, not too loose. But she speaks about it in other very interesting ways, and a lot of what she has to say about it is to talk about loneliness, which I'll get to fairly quickly, but I want to just read a little bit about her sort of introductory part here, just so you know where Pema is coming from, so that it'll make sense when I start reading further on in this little section. In the middle way, there's no reference point. The mind with no reference point does not resolve itself, does not fixate or grasp. How could we possibly have no reference point? To have no reference point would be to change a deep-seated habitual response to the world, wanting to make it work out one way or the other. If I can't go left or right, I will die. When we don't go left or right, we feel like we're in a detox center, or alone, cold turkey with all the edginess that we've been trying to avoid by going left or right. That edginess can feel pretty heavy. However, years and years of going left or right, going to yes or no, going to right or wrong, has never really changed anything. Scrambling for security has never brought anything but momentary joy. It's like changing the position of your legs in meditation. One leg hurts from sitting cross-legged, so we move them and we feel, phew, what a relief. But 2.5 minutes later, we want to move them again. We keep moving around seeking pleasure, seeking comfort, and the satisfaction that we get is very short-lived. We hear a lot about the pain of samsara, and we also hear about liberation, but we don't hear much about how painful it's going to be completely stuck to becoming unstuck. The process of becoming unstuck requires tremendous bravery, because basically we are completely changing our way of perceiving reality, like changing our DNA. We are undoing a pattern that is not just our pattern, it's the human pattern. We project onto the world a zillion possibilities of attaining resolution. We can have whiter teeth, a weed-free lawn, a stress-free life, a world without embarrassment. We can live happily ever after. This pattern keeps us dissatisfied and causes us a lot of suffering. I really like what she has to say here, because she points out to the deepest problem in our culture. And that's that we somehow think, if we just figured it out somehow, we could be happy all the time. Just, if I could just figure out, if I just got all the right things all lined up all together at the same time, then I'd be happy. And no matter how many times you try to do that, it never works. It never works. And we keep trying again and again and again. We keep somehow believing, you know. That's like that old definition of insanity is basically, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. We're just caught in that pattern over and over again. I want to go on now and read a little bit more of Pema here. He's talking about this, trying to stay in the middle path. Experience of certain feelings can seem particularly pregnant with desire for resolution. This desire to fix it somehow. Loneliness, boredom, and anxiety. Unless we relax with these feelings, it's very hard to stay in the middle when we experience them. We want victory or defeat, praise or blame. For example, if somebody abandons us, we don't want to be with that raw discomfort. Instead, we conjure up a familiar identity of ourselves as the hapless victim. Or maybe we avoid the rawness by acting out and righteously telling the person who messed up, he or she is. We automatically want to cover over the pain in one way or another, identifying with victory or victimhood. Usually we regard loneliness as an enemy. That's quite an honest statement. Usually we regard loneliness as an enemy. Heartache is not something we choose to invite in. It's restless and pregnant and hot with the desire to escape and find something or someone to keep us company. Can we rest in the middle? When we can rest in the middle, we can begin to have a non-threatening relationship with loneliness, a relaxing and cooling loneliness that completely turns our usual patterns upside down. And as I'm going to do throughout this, I'm going to read little bits from other people that sort of reflect on what Pema is saying here. This first is just a little poem by Hafiz that struck me as very relevant to this topic. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you, as few humans or even divine ingredients can. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly, which is what we're always trying to do. We're always trying to get rid of it. Please, I got to get rid of this, right? Then Pema goes on. She says, there are six ways of describing this kind of cool loneliness. This is what I thought was so brilliant about this chapter in her book. Six ways of describing this cool kind of loneliness. They are less desire, contentment, avoiding unnecessary activity, complete discipline, not wandering in the world of desire, and not seeking security from one's discursive thoughts. Pretty good list. The fact that she could actually think of six different kinds of loneliness fascinated me. That's really got me hooked on this. So I want to go through each of these, and she has a paragraph or two on each of these, and then just talk about it in different ways from other people. Less desire is the willingness to be lonely without resolution, when everything in us yearns for something to cheer us up and change our mood. Practicing, not the word practicing, this kind of loneliness is a way of sowing seeds so that fundamental restlessness decreases. In meditation, for example, every time we label thinking, instead of getting endlessly run around by our thoughts, we are training in just being here without dissociation. We can't do that now to the degree that we weren't willing to do it yesterday or the day before or last week or last year. After we practice less desire wholeheartedly and consistently, something shifts. We feel less desire in the sense of being less solidly seduced by our very important storyline. So even if the hot loneliness is there, and for 1.6 seconds we sit with that restlessness when yesterday we couldn't sit for even one, that's the journey of the warrior. That's the path of bravery. The less we spin off and go crazy, the more we taste the satisfaction of cool loneliness. As the Zen master Katagiri Roshi once said, one can be lonely and not be tossed away by it. So I found a really nice section in Jack Kornfeld's book, The Wise Heart, that reflects on this. And it's just one of just two sentences he says here, I think, are just spot on. And he's talking about how he gets caught. There's an addictive quality to my relationship to food, contact, sensuality, and a deeper unfulfilled loneliness. Unconsciously, I'm always trying to please people. What he's saying here is desire is sort of masking the loneliness that's underneath it. You know, it's like we want stuff because then I don't have, you know, because I have my stuff, and then I'm not going to feel so lonely. And this is quite an interesting thing to think about, I think. To look at it and go, oh, is this habit of desire that I have, this habit of wanting stuff, is it just, am I just trying to make myself feel good? Am I trying to sort of, you know, give myself a nice pat on the back, or be gentle with myself, you know, with one of the common things we hear people say sometimes. But be careful, because sometimes that leads to exactly this, just more desire. I'm kind of lonely. I know I'll go get myself a bowl of ice cream, or however it is you suit yourself. And it's a way of hiding from ourselves, hiding from that loneliness that lies underneath that desire. And so it's just something to, when we're caught in desire, when we're caught in wanting, in the broad sense of just wanting something, look at why that's there. And often that's what it's there for, is we're masking our loneliness, which is not skillful, I guess would be a good way, because it's not, remember, what we're trying to do with this practice is to be aware of what's actually there, what the truth of things are, what's actually arising, and we're hiding from what's arising by letting the desires take over. So then she goes on. The second kind of loneliness is contentment. When we have nothing, we have nothing to lose. We don't have anything to lose but being programmed in our guts to feel that we have a lot to lose. Our feeling that we have a lot to lose is rooted in fear of loneliness, of change, of anything that can't be resolved, of non-existence. The hope that we can avoid this feeling and the fear that we can't become our reference points. When we draw a line down the center of a page, we know who we are if we're on the right side and who we are if we are on the left side. But we don't know who we are when we don't put ourselves on either side. Then we just don't know what to do. We just don't know. We have no reference point, no hand to hold. At that point, we can either freak out or settle in. Contentment is a synonym for loneliness. Cool loneliness. Settling down with cool loneliness. We give up believing that being able to escape our loneliness is going to bring any lasting happiness or joy or sense of well-being or courage or strength. Usually we have to give up this belief about a billion times, again and again, making friends with our jumpiness and dread, doing the same old thing a billion times with awareness. Then, without our even noticing, something begins to shift. We can just be lonely, with no alternatives, content to be right here with the mood and texture of what's happening. So here she's talking really something that's quite central to the practice, and that's like being okay with whatever is here now. We have to somehow learn to go, yeah, that's okay. You know, not think there's something wrong that we have to fix. which is where we often go when we're caught in loneliness. Just, if I'm lonely, there must be something wrong. I must haven't got it figured out. And this is the opposite of contentment, right? Just be able to go, that's okay. I'm content with what I have. I don't need anything else. I don't have to have anything else. I can just be content with what I have right now. I'm not in any sense saying this is easy. I don't want to pretend that it is, because it isn't. But this is where the practice is trying to lead us to this place where whatever is arising, whether it's loneliness or boredom or whatever, we go, we see it, and then we're saying, and it's okay. I'm okay with the fact that it's like what she calls this cool loneliness. It's like, oh yeah, loneliness, this is what's here now. But we know, and this is the beauty of the meditative practice, is we know that this loneliness is just a feeling. It's just a mental arising. And like all mental arisings, guess what? It's going to arise, and then it's going to go. We might have to wait a while. It might become more often than we like. But we know it's going to go. We absolutely, if we really pay attention, see it going. It's just how we shift that understanding from, I got to get rid of it right now, to being, it's okay. Sylvia Boorstein, who I spent some time practicing with, when she teaches metta, you know, there's the second metta phrase is, may I be happy. And she said she could never felt comfortable saying, may I be happy. All she wanted to do is say, may I be content. It's like what a great wish. Huh? May I be content. Just, I'm okay with what I got now, whether it's, you know, physically what I've got now or mentally what I got now. I'm content. I'm okay with what's here now without having to do something about it in any way. Fix it. Pema goes on. The third kind of loneliness, avoiding unnecessary activities. When we're lonely in a hot way, we look for something to save us. We look for a way out. We get this queasy feeling that we call loneliness, and our mind just goes wild trying to come up with companions to save us from despair. That's called unnecessary activity. It's a way of keeping ourselves busy so you don't have to feel any pain. It could take the form of obsessively daydreaming of true romance, or turning a tidbit of gossip into the 6 o'clock news, or even going off by ourselves into the wilderness. The point is that all of these activities, we are seeking companionship in our usual, habitual ways, using our old, repetitive ways of distancing ourselves from the demon loneliness. Could we just settle down and have compassion and respect for ourselves? Could we stop trying to escape from being alone with ourselves? What about practicing not jumping and grabbing when we begin to panic? Relaxing with loneliness is a worthy occupation. As the Japanese poet Ryokan says, if you want to find meaning, stop chasing after so many things. This avoiding unnecessary activity is a reflection of another, I think I can safely call it a very closely related emotional energy that we often experience called boredom. Boredom is almost a synonym for loneliness, I think, sometimes. And I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation, here. It's called Thank You, Boredom. Joseph always has a little tongue-in-cheek in some of his titles. Like anger and other emotions, boredom most often fools us into diverting our energies entirely to an external situation. Thus, it keeps us from liberating ourselves by seeing our relationship to the emotion itself. We make a great mistake of boredom when we think that it comes because of a particular person or situation or activity. So much of the restlessness in our meditation practice and in our daily lives derives from this fundamental misunderstanding. How often do we try to find something new to recapture our interest, something more stimulating or more exciting? And how often does this too quickly become boring and dull, so that we range off again, looking for yet another something better? To realize that boredom does not come from the object of our attention, but rather from the quality of our attention, is truly a transforming insight. Fritz Perls, one of those who brought Gestalt therapy to America, said, "Boredom is a lack of attention." Understanding this reality brings profound changes in our lives. Then boredom becomes a tremendously useful feedback for us. It is telling us not that the situation of person or meditation object is somehow lacking, but rather that our attention at that time is half-hearted. Instead of wallowing in boredom or complaining about it, we can see it as a friend saying to us, "Pay more attention, get closer, listen more carefully." I had a very strong personal experience of this. The first long retreat, the first time I did a month-long retreat, which, if you want to feel lonely, try go on retreat and not talk to anybody for a month. It's sort of a boot camp in loneliness in some ways. Even though you're surrounded, in this case, I'd like there's 90 other people on the retreat. Right? But I remember about halfway through, so I'd been practicing for 2 weeks, and I was always a very sort of diligent student. I was sort of following the instructions. And at some point, I just got caught in this space of thinking, "God, this is so boring. We sit, and then we walk, and then we sit, and then we walk. Then we go get something to eat, and then we sit, and then we go." You know, it's like, give me a break. So, and I actually went into my teacher for an interview, and I basically just said what I just said to him, and he just sort of laughed at me, and he said, "You're just not paying enough attention. You're just not paying enough attention." And when he said that, it was like, oh, yeah, you know, my practice, you know, on retreat, you're trying to keep this continuity of practice, trying to keep practice going all the time. And my continuity was like not there. I was just spending a lot of my time just letting my mind wander off into all kinds of things, blah, 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 blah. And that's what was going on. And once I realized that, and then over, you know, the next, since then, 16 or 17, maybe 18 years now of practice, I realize more and more often when I label something boring, all I'm really saying, if I can be mindful and catch myself, is to say, oh, just pay more attention. I mean, just, you know, I love to just like sit in my backyard sometimes, you know, and I'm not like formally sitting, doing sitting practice, and just sit and watch what's going on in my backyard, which is not much. I mean, there's some squirrels and some birds, you know, and maybe a few flowers have come up that, you know, in the summer. But it's not like a big drama going on out there or anything. But it's like, oh, if I just really pay attention to all the little things that are going on, it's like so interesting. It's not boring at all. I mean, someone else might think, God, I look really bored because I'm just sitting there, right? But it's actually, once you learn to really pay attention in this way, boring isn't something that occurs so often. That it's not, and it doesn't have that power on you that it has before. I'm not saying I never get to that place, but it's much, much less frequent. And this is the practice allows us to sort of go past that stage where we think, if there's not some something really exciting happening. I need some action. That's what boring says. I need some action, please. Action is like, well, so actions come, that's fine. No action comes, that's fine too. Back to being content with what is. And Pema goes on again. She just keeps looking at it deeper and looking at it from all these different angles. Complete discipline is another component of cool loneliness. Complete discipline means that at every opportunity, we're willing to come back, just gently come back to the present moment. This is loneliness as complete discipline. We're willing to sit still, just be there, alone. We don't particularly have to cultivate this kind of loneliness. We could just sit still long enough to realize it's how things really are. We are fundamentally alone, and there's nothing anywhere to hold on to. Moreover, this is not a problem. In fact, it allows us to finally discover a completely unfabricated state of being. Our habitual assumptions, all our ideas about how things are, keep us from seeing anything in a fresh, open way. We say, oh yes, I know, but we don't know. We don't ultimately know anything. There's no certainty about anything. This basic truth hurts, and we want to run away from it. But by coming back and relaxing with something as familiar as loneliness, is good discipline for realizing the profundity of our unresolved moments of our lives. We are cheating ourselves when we run away from the ambiguity of loneliness. I love that sentence. We are cheating ourselves when we run away from the ambiguity of loneliness. Ambiguity being that, I want to go left or right. Well, what do I do now? But we don't have to do anything. It's like we're out sort of really paying attention to what's actually happening right now. I have so many books here, I have to keep looking, trying to find the right book. This is another little sentence from wrong page. Here we go. And this is Jack Kornfeld speaking again. He's talking about being on retreat and feeling lonely, like I was earlier. As I explored the loneliness, I found insecurity and a needy kind of emptiness. Once again, that's what lies underneath the loneliness. Insecurity and a needy kind of emptiness. That's strong words, I think, but it's like that's what's there. That we call it loneliness, but really, this is insecurity. It's like I'm feeling lonely because the insecurity is like, I don't know what to do here. I don't know how to do it. I can't figure this out. I just, how come this is going on? We get caught in that blah, blah, blah loop of figuring it out and blaming ourselves. And this is the insecurity hiding underneath that idea of loneliness, which we rush off and solve. If we can just stop doing that, if we can just stop having to rush off and figure it out and live with the insecurity of not being able to solve it, of not being able to fix it, of not being able to do anything other than just be with it. That's a really powerful teaching, you know, that we somehow, that loneliness we feel all the time is just an expression of I don't have any solidity here. I don't feel grounded. I don't have any control. I don't have any control over what's going on, which we always want. We always want to be in control, right? And now, when I'm lonely, I don't feel like I have any control over the situation. I'm just stuck in this lonely place, and I don't like it. We have the next section here, Pema, called Wandering in the World of Desire is another way to describe cool loneliness. Wandering in the world of desire involves looking for alternatives, seeking something to comfort us, food, drink, people. The word desire encompasses that addiction quality, the way we grab for something because we want to find a way to make things okay. That quality comes from never having grown up. We still want to go home and be able to open the refrigerator and find it full of our favorite goodies. When the going gets tough, we want to yell, "Mom!" But what we're doing as we progress along the path is leaving home and becoming homeless. Not wandering in the world of desire is about relating directly with how things are. Loneliness is not a problem. Loneliness is nothing to be solved. The same is true for any other experience we might have. I came across a rather interesting little tidbit of sutta here. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And it says, this is the Buddha, and he's talking about desire, about craving. And he talks about how people have craving as a partner. Like, it's so familiar to them, it's like their partner. And he's talking about someone who has overcome this, right? Even though a bhikkhu who dwells thus lives in the vicinity of a village, associating with bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, with male and female lay followers, with kings and royal ministers, with sectarian teachers and their disciples, he is still called a lone dweller. For what reason? Because craving is his partner, and he has abandoned it. Therefore, he is called a lone dweller. Someone who's learned to live with their loneliness is called a lone dweller. And it's because they've learned to abandon their craving. This, of course, being the constant theme in all of the Buddhist teaching. Abandon is a word you see a lot in the sutta because they're talking about, it's like a strong word. It's like, I'm not just trying to, you know, get rid of it a little bit, I'm going to abandon it. It's gone. And of course, Pema goes on. Another aspect of cool loneliness is not seeking security from our discursive thoughts. The rug's being pulled. The jig is up. There's no way to get out of this one. We don't even seek the companionship of our own constant conversation with ourselves. But how it is and how it isn't. Whether it isn't, whether it should be or it shouldn't be, whether it can or whether it can't. With cool loneliness, we do not expect security from our own internal chatter. That's why we are instructed to label it thinking. It has no objective reality. It is transparent and ungraspable. We're encouraging to just touch that chatter and let it go, not make much ado about nothing. This is so key to, I think, to meditation practice and life in general. You know, we put so much emphasis, so much belief in that babbling that goes on in our mind all the time. We somehow think it must really be important because it's in my mind, so it must be important, right? It's in my mind. Very special. Not just any old mind, it's my mind, and it's like we give it so much power and so much, like, it's got to be true, and I got to, you know, and this all comes down to our habit, particularly of having to somehow figure everything out. If I could just understand why I feel so lonely right now, then I wouldn't feel lonely anymore because I'd understand it. How? And of course, we all know that doesn't work. And instead, we just spin, and we you know, it could be this, and it could be that, and I remember this story, and you know, it's just this whirl of thought goes on and on and on, and it doesn't ever go anywhere. It's just having to abandon belief that our thoughts are relevant at all. And I'm not saying we shouldn't sometimes have to think to figure out, oh, am I going to go to the store today or tomorrow sort of thinking, you know, practical, live in the world of relative reality thinking. But so much of our thoughts have nothing to do with simple things like that. It's like we get caught in this figuring out why it has to be this way. Why did it happen? Why isn't it happening? Blah, 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 blah. It just goes on and on and on. Actually, I have two things to read about this. This is from a section from the Book of Joy called Loneliness. No need for introduction. Does anybody need an introduction to loneliness? And we all know what it is. We all know what that experience feels like. This is the author saying, having grown up in Manhattan, surrounded by 7 million New Yorkers, I knew exactly what the Dalai Lama was saying. As a boy, I never really met the people who lived on our apartment floor. I would occasionally hear their doors close with an empty metallic clang and locks turn behind them. If we did see them while waiting for the elevator, few words were spoken and eyes were averted. I was always bewildered by this willful avoidance and finally concluded that it must have been a defense against the crush of so many people crowded together. I thought the locked doors were apartment building floor. How could we have responsibility for people we did not even know? Those closed doors and the unseen people behind them were like a constant reminder that we were not connected. Now, as the Dalai Lama was speaking, I wondered if the averted eyes of my childhood, waiting for the elevator or in the subway, were perhaps the shame of being physically close and emotionally distant. We are the same human beings, the Dalai Lama said, returning to his most profound refrain. No need for introduction. Same human face. When we see one another, we immediately know this is a human brother or sister. Whether you know them or not, you can smile and say hello. I thought at the times I had smiled and spoken with warmth to the person waiting for an elevator or standing in the subway. Yes, sometimes my bid for human connection met with confusion, since it was not the social expectation, but most often there was a relieved smile, as if we had broken a trance and were once again acknowledging our human bond. The Dalai Lama had explained that in Buddhism, there is a recognition of our interdependence on every level. Socially, personally, subatomically. The Dalai Lama had often emphasized that we are born and die totally dependent on others, and that the independence we think we experience in between is a myth. I love that statement. The Dalai Lama has often emphasized that we are born and die totally dependent on others. The beginning and the ending of life. Huh? And the independence we think we experience in between is a myth. So this is talking about one of the main causes of loneliness, I think, and from the Buddhist perspective, is this idea that somehow we're separate. And if we're separate, then we can be lonely. And what the Dalai Lama's point to here is we're not separate at all. We just think we are. We get caught in this belief that we're separate. And this belief that we're separate leads directly to, oh, then I need to be with other people. But we're actually totally connected to everyone else all the time. Totally connected. There is no separation. This is the central teaching of the Buddha, that we're all interconnected all the time. We may not experience that, I'll grant you that, but this is just an illusion. This is just an illusion that somehow we're separate from everyone and everything. We're actually truly all connected. So how can we possibly be lonely? If we're connected to everything and everyone, how could that loneliness be there? If we just understood, if we experienced, if we connected to that sense of connection to everything, how could loneliness exist at the same time? One more thing. Well, a couple more things. This is, this sense of how we get caught believing in this sense of separation and not being part of the whole. And this is a wonderful section from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. It does not take too long to get a beginning sense that appearances arising in consciousness are not self. Because we see they keep coming and going. A subtle identification can still take place, however, with the knowing faculty itself. I'm the one who's knowing all these changing objects. You might believe the knowing is I, is self, because knowing or consciousness is much more subtle than other arising objects. You might find it difficult at first to be mindful of it, but as the mind's power of steadiness, stillness, and clarity grow stronger, we can actually become aware of awareness. At certain stages of meditation practice, it becomes clear that consciousness itself is a changing process. This discovery can be unsettling because for so long we've identified with the faculty of knowing as being most essentially who we are, taking it to be our soul, our self, our center. And now we see that it too, just like all other phenomena, continuously appears and passes away. So this is the big problem. We think this consciousness, this awareness that we are experiencing all the time, somehow at the root, that's who we are. That's that separate self that we keep trying to create. And this is like just happens to be the most perhaps subtle way we use to create the sense of a separate self. And Joseph has this really wonderful image. Imagine yourself dropping out of an airplane plane and free falling for a few minutes. Imagine the sense of exhilaration. But then you realize that you do not have a parachute. So you panic as you fall through space. Falling, 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 filled with terror that you do not have a parachute, until a certain moment arrives when you realize there is no ground. At that point of understanding, you just enjoy the ride. If we can just stop thinking that somehow we're a separate self, believing that, investing in it, putting an enormous amount of energy into creating this sense of a separate self, then the idea of loneliness disappears. We're just enjoying the ride. We're just moving through space, experiencing what there is to experience. That's all we can do. So I want to very briefly summarize here. And basically, I'm talking about our practice can help us learn to work skillfully with loneliness, to not struggle with it, to accept it, to calmly slow down, to intensify our awareness of it while not trying to figure it out. Just learn to say, and that's okay. It's okay. Loneliness is okay, just like all the other emotions we might feel. They're all okay. That's what our practice is leading us towards, slowly learning how to do. And I emphasize the word slowly. It's bit by bit. We learn a little more, a little more, a little more. We catch ourselves more often. That's all we can hope for. And finally, a little bit of poetry here. This is from Mary Oliver's book of poems called Thirst. She wrote this, most of these poems, soon after her partner of many years passed away. And so they have that sort of energy underneath, that lonely energy underneath them. This particular poem, I think, expresses this idea of loneliness quite beautifully. It's called Heavy. That time I thought I could not go any closer to grief without dying. I went closer, and I did not die. Surely God had his hand in this, as well as friends. Still I was bent, and my laughter, as the poet said, was nowhere to be found. Then said my friend Daniel, brave even among lions, it's not the weight you carry, but how you carry it. Books, bricks, grief, it's all the way you embrace it, balance it, carry it, when you cannot and would not put it down. So I went practicing. Have you noticed? Have you heard the laughter that comes now and again out of my startled mouth? How I linger to admire, admire, admire the things of this world that are kind and maybe also troubled. Roses in the wind, the sea geese on the steep waves, a love to which there is no reply. That's